Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Hoping the audio works for me this week. I know we had some audio problems last week. Wade, you and Matt, of course, sounded spectacular. I, of course, sounded like I was inside of a toilet being flushed. Brought me back to my high school days of attempted swirlies that never went well for anyone, but could
they
be.
It must have had a huge impact, though.
It had a partial impact. It did. Thank you for inquiring. I appreciate that very much. But So thanks for everybody for pointing out on the audio issues, because sometimes we don't know that until after the fact. So another great episode here. We want to talk about a few things. I've got, of course, Wade McFall, director here on our investigative team, and a retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG out of L.A. And, of course, Matt Kachansky, my counterpart, senior director of our payment integrity team, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director. So many hats. Get so little money for all of those hats. It's just unbelievable to me.
That's why I'm still working.
Yeah, that's why you're still until you die. So I get it. So today we want to talk. There was a press release that came out the other day. And while I will say that the press release itself wasn't overly interesting, there were just a few nuances in it that kind of create a spark of what is interesting. Texas, a guy in Texas. $60 million, nearly $60 million in fraud for DME, for braces, knee, back, you know, kind of the RoboCop of braces, $25 million in actual paid fraud in restitution from paid claims. He ran three different companies, one of which he put into someone else's name, which we'll talk about in a second. He got 90 months, and that comes out to about 7.5 years. And of course, with some good behavior, you get 54 days off. You're talking probably roughly, you know, 6.5 years or so, 6 years that he'll spend in prison. And of course, he's 65 years old, this guy. And the question always is it worth it? Was it worth it? And I suppose if you don't get caught, maybe it's worth it. But if you get caught and you got to pay back the $25 million, the first thing is, was the $25 million really the full amount? Probably some more, probably that we'll never see. But, you know, at 65 years old, is it worth going to jail for 6.5 years at 65 when your health is going to probably start to decline soon after? And you got to just, I guess you got to weigh out what your tolerance level is to spend 6 years in federal prison at 65 years old when you should be gearing up for retirement. But that's either here or there. Just a fact, right? Is, you know, you see these guys and gals getting 90 months or more. You know, my favorite is when you see these doctors that are in their 70s and 80s and they're getting 5-6 years in prison. I mean, that's a life sentence for someone. And you got to wonder at someone in their 80s, like, what are you doing, right? But this case, three DME companies, one was in his name, the other one was not, kind of run-of-the-mill, paying for leads resulting in DME coming from doctors, no relationship with the patients. It's kind of, we say it all the time, wash, rinse, repeat, the circus, you know, we talk about this all the time. And I think, you know, the frustration I think that SIU investigators get when they read these press releases and they wonder, and particularly people in leadership at plans are wondering, are these cases coming our way and we're just missing them? And I think the answer is yes, they are, because sometimes there's a little bit of a challenge. And Wade, I think, you know, for me, the first thing when I read this was the fact that there were two businesses, two DME companies in his name, and the third one was not in his name. That to me shows this guy knew something wasn't right, and that's intent. And so I think, you know, when you're looking from an investigational perspective, maybe you can find the two companies in his name, but maybe you're not going to be able to find the third one off the top. So maybe you have to do a little bit of digging and things of that sort. But, you know, obviously that helps from the OIG perspective and the criminal investigation perspective as far as an argument of intent. But coupled with that, and I think, you know, we could never harp on this or discuss this enough, is that there's inherently going to be frustrations in being able to identify the kickback arrangement and things of that sort. But certainly starting with data, looking and seeing that your referring providers are going to be the same. If this guy had three companies, even though one of them is not in his name, if you've got an outlier for one company, it's going to give you the names of the providers, and likely these are all the same providers, and that would ultimately get you to the third one. But, you know, I think this is one of those where I also think that thinking a little bit outside of the box is, what's the relationship between the plan and the not only the DME supplier, but what's the relationship between the payer, the plan, and the individual providers? Do you have the ability to get some documents that are outside of that norm, right? So we can take the same argument that we take when we're doing any investigation, which is starting with the provider agreements, right? These are things that may give you some pieces of the investigational puzzle. What can you ask for? What can you not ask for? What can you go to the referring providers for? What can you go to the DME supplier for, and maybe make some of those connections?
Right. And you'll definitely want to ask for, you can ask for all those contracts and agreements, but just to back up a little bit, when you're talking about different intent, like indicators, one of the things that this press release had talked about was how they would put certain labels into, like, the, I don't know if it's strictly the memo line on a check, but when they refer to things as marketing or lead generation or consulting or, you know, advertising services, they're trying to fit that into an exception to the kickback statute. And they just adding those labels does not make it legal. It's really irrelevant, because it's based on whether or not it falls into a kickback situation or an exception to a kickback is basically boils down to is the payment correlated with patient referrals? And the key thing here is volume. It's like there's the compensation increases as the order increases, or it's really based on a volume thing. There's the safe harbors that are available are kind of in contrast to that, where there's really two that we see in DME. It's personal service agreements or management contracts, and advertising or marketing services. And for the personal service agreements, there are certain things that have to be included for it to be an exception to the kickback. And that is, it has to be a written agreement. The term has to be for, I think it's in excess of 1 year. The compensation is based on, it's set in advance, and it does not fluctuate based on volume. And the payments are supposed to reflect a fair market value. So if they're going to claim that this is based on a personal service agreement, as an SIU investigator, you can request, you want to review those contracts and agreements and find out if these elements that are required for it to be an exception are actually in the agreements. The other one is advertising and marketing. Again, you can do this by some basic research, but basically they're allowed to run like digital or print ads, like campaigns and things of that nature, and providing brand promotion, but the payment again can't be tied to the number of patients or referrals. So again, you get the contracts and review that. If the compensation varies based on the numbers, that it won't fit into that safe harbor. So again, it goes back to, you know, if they're paying $200 per, you know, orthotic, or $100 per Medicare lead, you know, when they if they can get, they pay for a Medicare beneficiary who has a they used to call it a red, white, and blue card, a Medicare card that is billable. So if they're paying per item or per person, it kind of takes it out of the exception to a kickback. So and not only that, but the data, you know, if you're looking at the data, you can correlate, you know, if there's a payment made and the referrals increase or the DME provided increases, you can kind of correlate the payments to show that the payments are related to the volume. And again, that's a combination of looking at the contracts, the agreements, and really just basic data analysis, looking at the payments with the billings itself.
Yeah, and you know, the challenge in a kickback case is always that someone's got to tell on themselves, unless you can third party prove some indicia of FWA in that. And that becomes a big, I think, the big challenge. But from the data perspective, once you've got a little bit of the inkling, meaning we know that this DME provider might have a problem, whether it's volume, whatever that outlier is, and then you've identified who your universe of providers are, referring providers or ordering providers, you can kind of just go from there, because then the question becomes, well, if Dr. McFall is ordering all of these knee braces from ABC DME, where else is Dr. McFall ordering DME, or what else is he doing, right? So it kind of, it has to start with something, and then it's just a matter of kind of breaking it down. You know, when you look, I always think that my opinion is always any data that you look at will lead to you looking at other data. You can't just look at data individually. You have to then say, what else can I look at? Where else can I find these things? And I think it oftentimes comes down to what is the plan data getting you, and where else can you go with it? And you couple that with the contracts, and that will hopefully give you a little bit of information, because now we're starting to see a lot of these cases are starting to evolve into kickback arrangements where cash is not king anymore, where they're being paid, but they're being paid based upon some services agreement, consulting agreement, medical director. And some cases we're seeing it's not even volume based anymore, Wade. So the argument of volume is kind of going away, and they're giving these flat fee amounts, and those flat fee amounts aren't directly connected, air quotes, to volume, but for the fact that Dr. McFall was sending all of his patients to ABC DME, Dr. McFall wouldn't be doing anything with DME, right? You know, with ABC DME. And then, of course, you know, where are you geographically vis-a-vis where the DME company is? And so, Matt, that then gets to the, you know, I think there's a couple things. Is one, there always has to be a level setting of expectation when you're investigating any case, and you don't have the power of subpoena and search warrant, right? And I think where SIU investigators get frustrated, particularly I think we see it with retired law enforcement people that go into SIUs, is they feel like their hands are tied to an extent because they don't have that legal authorization of a search warrant or subpoena. And then, of course, people that are lifelong SIU investigators who are very conversant with the space can oftentimes run into levels of frustration just because they feel like they've hit a roadblock. So I think, you know, the two things which kind of go together are you don't have necessarily the ability to access a lot of things when you're doing these from the SIU perspective. And that will create, I think, some inherent frustration. So a little bit from a leadership perspective is managing expectations, and then also finding these ways to think outside the box. So, okay, you can't get financial records, but are there other pieces of that investigative puzzle that you can put forward? But I think, to me, I think managing expectations is number one. And then number two, or maybe the other way, is what are the parameters by which we can functionally operate within our world? And then how do you manage expectations from that?
To manage the expectations, kickback cases are a unique animal for an SIU, because you don't have the tools to really get to whether it is a true kickback under the law, because as Wade pointed out, there are certain things you have to prove, a quid pro quo, this payment was for this patient type of thing. You can't get to that granularity in terms of finances because you don't have subpoena authority. You can't get into bank records. You can't get into tax returns. You can get the contracts, but they might look legitimate on their face. So what do? Well, you start with the data, and you look to see, you know, has something changed? Has something spiked? Are you now seeing equipment from a specific DME company with one or two or just very few referring physicians? Then you look to the other side of that data. You look to the Benny history. Did these beneficiaries or members, do they have a history with the ordering physician or not? And then you start to build up your targeting of, okay, who do we need to talk to? There are still many investigative tools in the tool belt that you can use, interviewing being one of the most important ones. Once you see that, you know, a beneficiary maybe or a member has received, you know, the mummy kit from company A, and then also company B billed for the same ones, got denied because it was duplicate, but you've seen, why would two different companies, same referring physician, why would this member be getting all that? And you start to reach out to those members that you have been able to identify as the most vulnerable, that would have the most information. And then what questions do you ask that member? Is it A, did you get the equipment? Did you need the equipment? Were you ever evaluated or examined by a physician or a provider for the purpose of getting this equipment, to get it sized, custom made, da da da, all of those things? Did you know that medical doctor? Did you know that physician? Have you ever met him before? And find out what those answers are. And in that way, you can start building up a pretty good pattern of this equipment either was never sent, was sent, is still in the box, so it's not needed. They didn't know the physician's name that was the ordering physician. They'd never met them, whatever it might be. Or they were getting, you know, solicitations from multiple companies. You know, how did this company ever come to know who you were? Find out how that was. Did they violate some of the direct marketing aspects of for DME companies? And then perhaps even you have also medical review. You can look, you know, did this, you can look at the claims that come in for this patient, the diagnosis, the condition of this patient. Did they need this equipment to begin with? So you can build up a very good package for denying all of these claims. And perhaps, again, this is going back to some old conversations we had, if you have a law enforcement liaison as part of your SIU, you can talk to them about what is the next strategy here about, we've taken this as far as we can go, but we think there's more here. What's the best way to get this information to the appropriate authorities that can take it to the next level, get the financial information, and maybe get criminal or civil actions against this company that's taking it, you know, advantage of your plan and probably many, many other ones. So there are tools in the tool belt that can get you, you know, to where you need to be. It's just you have to be able to identify them, use your resources well to identify the members and the providers that you really need to reach out to speak with.
You know, and you bring up a good point, Matt, and that is that there are some cases where talking to members may have minimal value. In other instances, there may be great probative value in talking to members. And I think one of the things that investigators have to really be able to key into on some of these cases, you know, these mail order cases, whether it be a mail order piece of DME, prescription medication, you know, we're seeing instances with genetic test kits being mailed. And ultimately, you know, what we hear a lot of times is the member, the beneficiary, whoever the patient is, will say, oh, I didn't question this because, you know, I have a sore wrist and I thought that Dr. McFall, whose name was listed as the ordering doctor, was working with my primary care doctor. And so, you know, we see that all the time where the member either is being told, oh, we work with your doctor. I saw this a ton when I was doing a bunch of these diabetic test strip cases, these mail order test strip cases, where the company was calling and soliciting the patient, and they would say, we work with your doctor, and it's generic. We work with your doctor. Well, yeah, we work with your doctor to get them to sign off on this order after you've given us the opt-in, right? And so these are only things I think that come from training and education and experience, but there really is a point where when you're doing these interviews, you have to be able to key in on these simple things that seem innocuous at the time, but actually become very important factors. If I ever heard a member, a beneficiary, a patient say, I didn't question it because I thought that so-and-so worked with my doctor, like that immediately is like, because in what world does that happen? If you need a brace, your doctor is ordering the brace. If you need a prescription for a medication, your doctor is ordering that for you. If you need new diabetic test strips, your doctor is ordering that for you. So I think a lot of this comes down to that mentoring, that liaison work, that, you know, cohesiveness that comes from payment integrity and SIU, and, you know, just becoming more conversant, you know, in that. And so, Wade, I want to go to you for kind of the last dibs on this, which is, I think, you know, what we find oftentimes is when these cases come our way, investigators are very quick to just turn around and say, well, there's nothing here to work on because it's a kickback case, so I shouldn't really do anything. How do you, you know, how do you motivate someone who already realizes that the thing that they have to investigate is probably not going very far? What are some of the ways you can maybe motivate someone to keep their head in the game to kind of continue on the hunt?
Well, as Matt said, a lot of the tools are not available to an SIU, but there are tools there that can get you to the goal line, basically, and the main one being interviews. And I think if you step back and look at the real, like, the reason for the anti-kickback laws, it's because the claims, when there's kickbacks involved, it's no longer about medical decision making for the benefit of the patient or the beneficiary. They're not making these decisions as good health care or good medicine. They're doing it basically on profit as the key, you know, motivator. And the things that Matt talked about will get you to that same line. If they're getting equipment that, well, first of all, if they're not getting the equipment, they're billing for it and not getting the equipment or services, that's the big one. But if it's not medically necessary, if they have an elbow brace or a knee brace, and you talk to the member or the patient, again, interviews, and you find out that they don't have an issue with their whatever body part, you know, the equipment is useless to them, I mean, that's huge. And the same thing is if, you know, it's ordered by, you know, doctor whatever, and they've never been to that doctor, or they don't have a history, the first crossover into Medicare with that doctor is when they order all this equipment, but there hasn't been a series of, you know, visits leading up to that would show what you would expect. You know, they're looking at different conditions and symptoms, and
right,
that might lead to ordering this equipment. But if they don't have that, you know, that's a problem. And again, a lot of those tools are not there, but the interview is, and that's probably the most valuable one that you can really get to the bottom of these situations.
Yeah, and I think the take home is that at the end of the day, what sometimes may obviously appear to be a case that's not going to have any legs to it turns out to have legs to it. And sometimes it's a matter of just finding the right person to talk to get to that point, to understand, do you have something there or are you spinning your wheels? Unfortunately, the situation winds up being that you don't know whether or not something has legs or not until you've invested some time and effort. And, you know, and we talk about this all the time, and you know this, Wade, you could spend as much or more time on a $50,000 case than a $1 million case. And I think the thing that investigators always need to think about, and we were just in a meeting recently where this came up as a discussion point, is that it's not a matter of how many cases does an investigator have, it's the quality of the cases, and more so it's understanding that a $1 million case can take less time than a $50,000 case just because of some of the complexities that are out there. You could have a case involving one $50,000 claim, and it just could be such a complex issue that requires a lot more investigating and policy interpretation, all that, versus a $1 million case that involves, you know, COVID testing. Did they have it? Did they not have it? Something a little bit more straightforward. So you sometimes don't know what the gift is going to be until you've unwrapped it. Right. And, you know, one of the things that I've been really harping on a lot when we do training and education and talking to people is, you're an investigator in this space. Curiosity is not a bad thing. Like, it's okay to be curious, and it's okay to think about outside the box and talk to people and kind of get their opinions. And I think where sometimes the frustrations come in is if you've interviewed two or three people and they're not giving you the answers that get you where you want to go, is it possible that you've just not interviewed the right two or three people? And I think that's part of that, is that discussion, is understanding, are you interviewing the right people for what you're seeking to get answers for? We're not saying that you need to go to the well and interview 100 people for something, but there is that level of identifying whether or not you're interviewing the right people relative to that frustration level that you have. So
I just want to throw one thing out there. There are certain criteria to help protect the plan. CMS has certain criteria for implementing payment suspensions against providers. And I'm not saying you can do that, but maybe to implement a prepay. One of the things is, you talk to three beneficiaries and they said the services weren't rendered or the equipment wasn't delivered or I never wanted or needed the equipment. that's good enough to do like a payment suspension against the DME. Maybe you do those three beneficiary or member interviews and they say didn't get the equipment or got it, here it is, it's still in the box and didn't want it, never wanted it, didn't know the physician. Maybe that's enough just to put the DME company on prepay. And then you start, you know, stopping the bleeding at least.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even though I said that Wade would have the last
dibs, I know. I'm sorry.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I guess
I'm wearing the shirt.
I guess.
Okay. So I got one more thing. Then I got to have one more. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think the problem, Matt, is that as a kid growing up, you were typically picked last for kickball, and so this is the way that you're trying to make up for that.
They made me ump it. Yeah, I was the umpire.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I get it. Well, you know, look, kickback cases are a challenge. They're a challenge when you've got all of the authorities under law enforcement for subpoenas and search warrants and cooperating witnesses and all that. They're a challenge just from that perspective. So, you know, I think the thing is just continue to work these cases, continue to think about data in ways that you didn't normally think about data. Consider how you can meld data and look at providers from different perspectives and where else they're doing their things. And just know that a lot of these cases may not go very far, but it's certainly worth at least exhausting it and making that decision, because you'll get better each time you work one. And the nuggets, the cream rises to the top. So it's just a matter of time. So keep up with it and keep working on these cases. These press releases give you a lot of nuggets as to where the fraud, waste, abuse schemes are. And theoretically, they give you a little bit of information on where you can spend your investigative time to hone your craft a little bit better. So as always, great insight from you guys. I appreciate it. Kickback cases are a challenge. Wade, you brought up some great points involving designated health services and safe harbors and all of that stuff. That's also a very important piece of that puzzle. So keep on working these cases, keep on reading these press releases. Again, we appreciate everybody spending their time coming every week for our podcast, as well as our LinkedIn Lives. And of course, if you want a little bit of humor in your day, you can tune into Gene Marie's Long Island Library. There are two R's in library last time I checked. But of course, I think people from Long Island sometimes forget that the alphabet is 26 letters, not 25 letters, but that's okay. And as always, jump onto our website, sign up for our newsletter, catch us on LinkedIn, and continue to follow us. And again, YouTube, Spotify, and all of that. Thanks, guys. And thanks, everybody. And we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.